You're listening to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech Radio, with me, Danielle Lazarová. Coming up in today's program, the last British Wellington bomber undergoing final stage of restoration work could be used to honor Czechoslovak World War II airmen. We'll find out more from Czech Radio's correspondent. After that, a fresh edition of Mailbox and a letter from Prague. All that coming up, so do please stay with us. Public broadcaster Czech Radio has backed an initiative for a Vickers Wellington bomber undergoing restoration work in Great Britain to feature the markings of the Czechoslovak 311th Squadron, which flew with that type of RAF bomber in World War II. Czech Radio's correspondent in London, Jiří Hošek, first learned of the reconstruction project last autumn and came forward with the idea. What are the chances the plane could feature the colours of the 311th? And what is the aircraft's place in Czechoslovak military history? Jan Wellinger spoke to Jiří Hošek on a line to London.
The significance is immense, and all Czech lovers of World War II history have this bomber on top of their list, together with, of course, Spitfires and Hurricanes. And Vickers Wellington was the main bomber, the main aircraft used by 311 Bomber Squadron, the Czechoslovak Bomber Squadron, which was part of the Royal Air Force throughout the war. It was used during bomber raids on Germany and other targets in Western Europe from 1940 onwards. So it is a very famous aircraft indeed, and plays a huge role in Czech military history. And I think even people in the Czech Republic who are not that familiar with this part of history have heard of Wellington before.
And if we describe a little bit the appearance of the plane, as you say, one of the signature planes of World War II and of the RAF, it does have that classic look. Could you tell me a little bit about what it's like to see it up close?
Definitely, it's a huge airplane, but it's not full of metal and full of glass as some of the American bombers of World War II, like a B-17. In fact, the fuselage of Wellington is still full of wooden framings, and it is covered by linen. So, in fact, when you're standing very close to Wellington bomber, you're thinking, oh my God, I mean, how on earth this aircraft was so effective all the way till 1942, 1943. It's definitely very robust. It's a twin-engine bomber, but it's not as impressive as some of the bombers from the later stages of World War II, like Lancasters, Halifaxes, or Stirlings.
How rare is this particular plane? Is it true that this is the last survivor, so to speak?
It's the last basically fully intact or complete Vickers Wellington. There is another Wellington which was recovered from Loch Ness in the 1980s, which is on display in one of London's museums. But this particular Vickers Wellington is really extremely, extremely rare. And I must admit, I did not know about its existence before my trip to RAF Cosford in autumn 2014. So I was really caught by surprise. And it is an aircraft which was not in operational use. It was only used for training purposes in the latter stages of the war. And this, of course, contributed massively to the fact that it remained in relatively good shape until the 21st century.
What happened to the other planes? I suppose those that weren't shot down, were they decommissioned after the war? Were they systematically taken apart, destroyed?
Exactly. They were just taken apart, destroyed. As you know, some metal parts, or basically all metals, were extremely rare after World War II. And Vickers Wellington was already outdated in 1945. So at that time, there was no real thought about keeping this part of history alive by preserving, let's say, 10, 15 or 20 Wellington bombers and sending them to museums all around the world. That did not exist at that year.
I read that the reconstruction has taken several years in Cosford. What, in a nutshell, does that kind of project involve? Because in my mind, even if the plane was in good condition or fairly complete. There must have still been a lot of paperwork, research involved, and then the actual physical restoration. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
I would probably emphasize that I was extremely, extremely impressed by the work that is being done by the experts in the conservation center at Cosford. I mean, you can imagine what happens to any wooden and metal object which is 70 plus years old. So we are talking about corrosion, we are talking about rotten wooden frames, linen which was used to cover the fuselage, which is now extremely fragile. In fact, it was already removed a couple of years ago, and now new linen from Northern Ireland will be purchased to cover the fuselage. So it's a long, systematic work, and I was really impressed that the experts at RAF Cosford are really trying to be as authentic as possible. So their really desire is to make the Wellington look exactly the way it looked in 1944, 1945.
Did you learn about any particular aspects where, say, novel solutions were required?
There are one or two, I think, stages of the reconstruction where certain innovation is required. The big question was, because as I mentioned, Wellington was used for training purposes, and I think big question was or still is whether the front turret, where the front gunner was sitting with his machine gun, will actually be part of that plane, because it was removed when it was flying for training purposes. And actually, this is the main reason why I'm not particularly optimistic about the result of our initiative, because if we are talking about having this Wellington done in the 311 squadron markings, its military livery, it would be contradictory to the fact that this particular Wellington was never used by 311 squadron, and in fact, it did not fly operationally, and it was solely used for training purposes.
Bring me in a little bit about why the Czechs or the Czechoslovaks should, in your view, have those markings put on the plane. Did they make the plane famous, so to speak?
I think they certainly made the airplane famous, but they were not the only ones. Of course, British bomber pilots and Poles and New Zealanders flew Wellingtons as well, massively. We have to say that 311 Squadron was extremely successful on a number of occasions. The unit and its individuals received high decorations. They won numerous awards of being the best bomber squadron of Royal Air Force. So it was not an ordinary squadron of Royal Air Force. And I think it would be a great tangible symbol of gratitude of British people to Czech and Slovak airmen, members of 311 Squadron, but also to other Czechoslovak soldiers who fought in World War II in the West. Just a gratitude for their contribution in the final victory.
And tell me a little bit about some of those who are supporting this project. There's Czech Radio, obviously, the British Embassy in Prague.
That's correct. It's the British Embassy in Prague. It's the Czech Embassy here in the United Kingdom. It's some of the veterans organizations and associations in the United Kingdom, which are now run actually by sons and grandsons of Czechoslovak airmen, including members and former members of 311 squadrons. I was very happy for the support received by Prague's Military History Institute. That meant and means a lot to me and for the initiative. And I was extremely glad that the project or the initiative also received full support of one of the British MPs, in fact, a very influential MP from the Conservative Party, Greg Hands, according to my knowledge, the only current MP who speaks Czech, so his support was kind of logical.
And at what point should we know more? When will the decision be made?
I think the decision is should be made in a couple of weeks' time. But as I said, the signals or informations coming from Cosford are not particularly optimistic because they really did not calculate with this alternative of 311 Squadron marking. So it really, in a sense, this initiative is a very, very late entry. I think we should know in a matter of weeks or months.
Czech Radio's correspondent in London, Jiří Hošek, speaking there to Jan Wellinger. And it's now time to leave the mic to Pavla Horáková for a fresh edition of Mailbox. Hello and welcome to the first edition of Mailbox in 2015. Many thanks for all your New Year's wishes and all your feedback, including reception reports and quiz answers. Now straight on to your emails. Colin Law from New Zealand responded to an email quoted in the last edition of this program.
Please don't be persuaded to alter your English pronunciation to suit one listener who has not learned the English language. I was born in England in the Northern Hemisphere and now live in an English-speaking country on the opposite side of the globe in the Southern Hemisphere, and I have always understood Z to be the pronunciation of the final letter of the English alphabet. Perhaps your listener should look for pronunciation guides online to help him understand the pronunciation used by the majority of English speakers, and I include your very capable English-speaking Czech staff in that majority.
Thank you for your message, and rest assured that we shall stick to the pronunciation we are used to. Of course, should an American reporter join our staff and prefer the pronunciation Z, we will not force him or her to say Z. Joanna Shelton from the US state of Minnesota sent us this query.
I have an old shortwave radio on which my father listened to the fall of Prague to the Nazis. He always remembered the theme music but could never identify it, nor could I, the professional musician of the family. He remembered a horn call. A friend thought Smetana, the Moldau, but I think it might be from Dvorak's New World Symphony. I would be so grateful if you could tell me which movement of which piece was that haunting theme. My dad died 30 years ago.
I believe the motif you have in mind is Radio Prague's signature tune, which indeed comes from the first movement of Antonín Dvořák's New World Symphony. Let's have a listen. Thank you for your messages. And now let's take a look at your quiz answers. As always, Hans Werner Lollicke from Denmark was one of the first to send his in.
Thank you for coming back to Church Affairs, or is it also politics? You never know. At least many historians see the travel of Oderic of Pordenone, OFM, from Italy as far as Beijing, visiting many countries on his way, as a diplomatic mission of the Pope. Oderic was born in Pordenone in Italy. He became a Franciscan monk and was obviously a talented youth around 1286. He was sent as a missionary to the Balkans and later on to Asia in 1318, travelling slowly between the missionary centres set up by the Franciscans in India and the South Asian countries. He might have been as far as Lhasa in Tibet as the first known European. After returning to Italy, he told his story to Brother William of Salagna, from whose script in Latin his travel to Asia was known. For historians, it's been difficult to verify details of the story, but the story itself has had an immense impact on church history.
Valery Lugovsky from Belarus writes,
participation in researching your quiz allows one to rein in one's own pride and arrogance and put it in place. Indeed, the world is so big and so long-lasting that one's own knowledge of it is only a teaspoon, a thimble in the ocean. Also, I slightly smile, it begins to seem that everything in this world has its origins in the Czech lands. Instead of repeating his biography, which my colleagues in Mailbox will certainly talk about in interesting details, I will focus on only one of the legendary items ascribed to the monk, traveler, and diplomat, whose achievements were no smaller than those of Marco Polo. He always wore a hair shirt or chainmail on his bare body. He never desired to take up any post, but only did rough work. He was constantly fasting with bread and often only with water. The bread was usually baked from red grain, which is given to donkeys instead of oats. Before his trip across the sea with the permission of his abbot, he lived in the forest and led the life of a hermit or recluse.
This is what Mary Lou Krennic from Texas wrote.
In 1314, Blessed Odoric of Pordenone left for the Orient. He travelled and preached in Armenia, Media and Persia. The Franciscans had founded mission centres in these countries. He then sailed to India and the islands of Ceylon, Sumatra and Java. He pushed forward to China and, preaching Christ crucified along the way, he finally arrived at the capital of Cambalac, or present-day Beijing. There he met the great apostle of China, the Franciscan friar John of Monte Corvino, who had been appointed Archbishop of Cambalac in 1307. After 3 years of fruitful labour in China, he resolved to go back to Europe to submit a report of his 15 years apostolic labour to the pontiff. He travelled through China, Tibet and Central Asia, and returned to Italy in the year 1330, 65 years old and emaciated by sufferings of various kinds.
B. Sivashan Mugam from India sent in this brief answer.
Odoric of Pordenone was born at Villanova. He came from a Czech family named Matiusi. He had visited Tana, Malabar and Puri in India. He visited Peking and stayed there for 3 years.
While Colin Law from New Zealand wrote one of his thorough biographies.
The travels, which Odoric would subsequently write about in great detail, began in April 1315, when he was sent to follow a group of missionaries who had preceded him to the east. He went from the Black Sea through Persia and on to India, Ceylon, Sumatra and Vietnam, and then to Canton in China. In China, he visited several cities before reaching Peking, the city of the Great Khan, where he stayed for 3 years. By the time he reached Italy in 1330, Odoric was 65 years old, and his 15 years of often arduous missionary exploration had taken its toll of him, so that he was not immediately recognisable to his compatriots. He was passing through Pisa on his way to report to the Pope when he met an old man dressed as a pilgrim. The old man told Odoric, "Return to your convent, for in 10 days you will depart this world." Odoric set out for the convent in Udine, but on the way he stopped to rest in Padua, where he dictated his account of his journeys to Brother William. The account did not detail the hardships and dangers he encountered, but it is very descriptive of the people and places that Odoric had encountered, with so much detail about the customs and living conditions. Odoric then went on to the convent at Udine, where he died on 14th of January 1331. In 1755, the Pope Benedict XIV formally sanctioned beatification of Odoric.
This answer is from Jayanta Chakrabarti from India.
Odoric's name stands out prominently in the annals of history of early European missionaries to travel to India. Crossing through Persia, he landed in northern Bombay to gather the remains of Franciscans martyred to be buried in China. He is reported to have travelled quite extensively while in India, visiting the Christian centres of the Malabar coast, Calicut, Coromandel coast, Madras and the Nicobar Islands. He remained in China for 3 years, learning about the country and its people. Through his comprehensive narrative, the world learned many unique facts of China and the Chinese people, which Marco Polo did not mention in his travels. On his return journey, he travelled through Lhasa, probably the first European to visit Tibet. It is alleged that his excellent account of his travels was plagiarised by Mandeville, which became popular among the geographers of that period. The accounts of his travelogue were available in Prague as early as 1340, and was also popular in Italy, France, Germany and England in Latin, French and English, the most popular English version being Cathay and the Way Thither. This humble Czech was laid to rest in Udine on January 14th, 1331.
Deblina Biswas, also from India, wrote,
"He started preaching to the East from 1318 AD, and for this mission he went to Constantinople, Venice, Armenia, Persia, Baghdad and other places. Then he came to India and landed near Thane in Bombay, now Mumbai. During his stay in India, he also came to Puri and had the experience to witness the world-famous chariot festival of Lord Jagannath there. From India, he went further to Sumatra, Java, Borneo, the Philippines, Mongolia, and then to China, where he stayed for nearly 3 years between 1324 and 1327 AD. On his return journey, he went to Mongolia, Tibet, Tabriz, Venice, and then finally returned to his homeland in late 1329 AD. Odorico's globetrotting can be best described as a diplomatic mission in addition to its religious dimensions. About 73 manuscripts of Odorico's narratives in Italian, French and Latin are known to exist. While travelling towards the papal court in Avignon, Odorico fell ill at Pisa and later died in Udine on January 14, 1331 AD.
And another of our Indian listeners, Dipita Chakrabarti, writes,
Odorico of Pordenone, born of noble Czech-Italian parents in 1265 in Friuli, entered the Franciscan order when only 15 years old. Following a strict life of penance, solitude and study, he zealously prepared himself to be a missionary and rose to be a successful and revered priest. Followers travelled great distances to hear his sermons. But in his heart, Odorico harboured a desire to win the souls for God in the so-called heathen countries of the East. He travelled extensively through Armenia, Persia, India, Indonesia to China, founding missions and meeting the great apostle Franciscan John of Montecorvino, who had been appointed the Archbishop of Peiping, now Beijing. Returning to Europe, he submitted a report of his 15 years of apostolic work to the Pontiff John XXII in the hope of securing fresh recruits for the apostolate. However, being of humble nature, he suppressed his untold sufferings, hardships, and torture he had encountered. His miracles at his tomb were recognized with honor by Pope Benedict in 1775. Followers erected an imposing memorial at Pordenone to remember him for posterity.
Thank you very much for your answers. This time, our prize goes to Deblina Biswas from India. Congratulations. And here's a new question for the coming weeks. This time we would like to know the name of the Czech inventor, industrialist and anti-Nazi resistance fighter born in 1894 in the Moravian town of Vsetín. He registered dozens of patents in the field of electrical and mechanical engineering, among them also a design of a vertical takeoff and landing aircraft. Please send us your answers by February the 18th to the usual address, english@radio.cz. That's also where you can send us your comments and questions. You can also keep in touch with us via Facebook and Twitter. We'll be looking forward to your feedback. Until next time, take care.
Pavla will be back in 4 weeks' time, and now we'll round off this half-hour broadcast from Radio Prague with a letter from Prague, courtesy of Ian Willoughby.
One is so used to black-and-white photographs depicting Tomáš Garrigue Masaryk, the founder of Czechoslovakia, as stern, dignified, even iconic-looking, that a video posted on YouTube in which he playfully speaks to camera is almost startling. The clip was recorded at the Lani presidential residence by Fox Movietone News in November 1929, when the country's first president was 79, and it really is extraordinary. In it, the Tatínek, or daddy of the Czechoslovak nation, addresses viewers in America in heavily accented English and outlines a remarkable dream of the future. Charmingly, he begins his talk with a reference to the weather, which is fine, he says, after the fogs, though this sound rather like fox, of the last week. With a twinkle in his eye, he then points to the camera, saying he has yet to see and hear the new film. This wasn't long after the arrival of talkies. It is, he goes on in scratchy video and audio, a great invention of America, and no doubt not the last the country will produce. But the grinning president goes further, quite a bit further, If I observe the inventiveness of our modern scientists, he says, I sometimes fancy a much greater invention, to see and hear in the distance without any wire. From your sitting room you could observe the jungles of Africa and what the wild beasts are doing there. And more, says Masaryk, you could hear and see what the jungles of our human society are doing. This would force every man to be honest, and the secret plotting of, and I quote, all the wickedness would come to an end. Wonderful, no, he says. Frankly, I'm not quite sure what the great man was outlining. Perhaps some kind of a benign universal live CCTV system meets wireless internet. Whatever, the fact that he was suggesting this 85 years ago, a mere 3 years after the first transatlantic telephone call, shows striking vision and imagination. Masaryk's tech dream is followed by an almost comical series of rough cuts of him standing in the grand gardens of Lani Chateau near Prague, where he was to die almost 8 years later. In the next clip of him speaking, he says that we Europeans can learn a lot from America. He himself has learned something valuable in Washington, he says, from a good horseman who told him that one's lungs took in twice as much air while riding as walking. So, says the almost 80-year-old Masaryk, I'm going to take my morning ride.
And that letter has brought us to the end of today's programme from Prague. You'll find us online at radio.cz. Should you like to contact us, then please write to english@radio.cz. We'll be glad to hear from you. This is Daniela Zarová saying thanks for joining us today and take care.